We turn now to the latter portion of Davis' chapter on the Council of Nicaea, sections 3, 4, and 5 of this chapter, the events, the significance, and then we'll look very briefly at the aftermath of the council. In section 2.3, the events of the council, Davis invites us to meditate for a moment on the fact that it was the emperor who called this council. This remains a very important principle that is current in ecumenical theology, because in the Orthodox churches, it is, at least in their strict theology, in their strict tradition, only the emperor who has the right to call an ecumenical council. Not the Pope, not the Bishop of Rome, but the emperor. And so the definition of an ecumenical council will be different in East and in West. It was Constantine who called this first ecumenical council, and that is particularly remembered in the Eastern churches, even though the Bishop of Rome was given a pride of place in terms of signing the documents of the council, even when he was not physically present, or even present in the person of his legates. If we look at the section below the pictures, and by the way, the pictures are intended to remind us of Constantine's importance contemporaneously. There is this colossal bust of Constantine, which is in the style of the earlier divinized emperors with eyes looking upwards. Constantine regarded himself, at least early in his career, as not just a worshiper of, but in a very close relationship with the sun god, who was to some extent becoming identified with Christ. There was a kind of an uneasy mixture of solar monotheism and Christianity. And then finally, his real conversion to Christianity is perhaps symbolized best by this rather ambiguous depiction of an icon of Constantine as saint. He is regarded as a saint in the Orthodox churches. This despite the fact that he more or less eliminated the whole of his family at the end of his life to make sure that his sons would be able to inherit his empire. This was done, if not with his direct orders, it was certainly done with his knowledge. So there is a lot to be concerned about in terms of Constantine's lifestyle and morals, but he is venerated as a saint in the Eastern churches. If we drop down on the page, there's a very good summary which Davis cites, in which it's pointed out that Constantine regarded himself as having the right to call the council because he was, in his own mind, and was coming to be regarded by members of the clergy, and as well as see especially by the Arian clergy, as divinity on earth. He was given by God supreme power in things material and spiritual. It was his foremost duty to lead men to God. So the emperor is acquiring a kind of a quasi-divine state, that which, ironically, the Christian church denied the emperor by refusing to offer incense to his genius during the eras of pagan persecution. Now, rather ironically, step by step, the Byzantine emperor is coming to assume and to be offered a similar kind of veneration, and incorporating as well, at least as far as the East is concerned, the right to immerse himself in and even settle church affairs. Although, as we'll see, the synodal or conciliar process allowed for at least the theoretical independence of the bishops. The point is described, if we drop down a little bit, in terms of an element of procedure, modeling themselves perhaps on the Roman Senate. The emperor was present but didn't have the right to vote at the council. It is presumed that that was the case in Nicaea. It certainly was the case in subsequent councils, although we lack the minutes of the council itself. And this is a kind of a suggestion of the possibility of autonomy, but also a hint and a foreshadowing of the very significant role, and even a dominating role, that the emperor would come to play in subsequent councils of the church. If we drop down to the next highlighted text, to a description of the council itself, Eusebius of Nicomedia, who would become the very important leaders of the Arian party in subsequent years, first attempted to defend a creed that was sympathetic to Arius and Arianism, and it was rejected. Then Eusebius of Caesarea was next, who offered an attempt at finding a creed that would be acceptable. Although his did not serve the purpose, it seems to have at least moderately vindicated him and gotten him off the hook of having been excommunicated at the earlier council that had met just before Nicaea. And so the Council of Antioch's excommunication was more or less set aside as far as Eusebius of Caesarea was concerned. Then finally, the creed that was accepted seems to have been a Syro-Palestinian creed, which served as the basis for the creed that we've looked at in another lecture, and which will ultimately, with its modifications in 381 at Constantinople, become the so-called Nicene Creed, but is in fact the Creed of Nicaea and Constantinople. Davis points out, in a very helpful way if we drop down, that the term homoousios was not a term that had an absolutely clear and single meaning. It could refer to a generic commonality of substance or essence, or it could refer to numerical identity in concrete being, or it could refer to a kind of material identity, being made of the same, and this is in the a non-technical sense of the word, substance. And then, as Davis points out, the council was particularly concerned to stress the equality of the Father and the Son, and so they seem to have had this first meaning primarily in mind, generically being of the same substance. But of course, Athanasius will go on to include the sense of a numerical identity as well. And the point that Davis next makes, as of Constantine being the one who seems to have emphasized this term, homoousios, did so apparently primarily at the instigation of Osius of Cordoba, his bishop advisor in matters theological. And he adds ironically, David adds ironically in a highlighted text, homoousios coined by the Gnostic heretics, proposed by an unbaptized emperor, jeopardized by naive defenders, but eventually vindicated by the Orthodox, was added to the Creed of Nicaea to become a sign of contradiction for the next half century. And he anticipates the aftermath of the council that as the first flush of enthusiasm for this term fades away, the Arians gradually seek to set aside Nicaea, and that for the next 50 years or so, the Christian world, especially the Christian East, will become progressively more Arian. And this term, homoousios, will gradually be not just ignored, but other councils will meet and try to have it set aside as a not very helpful term or as a term that can no longer be used. So it's going to be a return to Nicene vocabulary that will allow the vindication of the Orthodox position to take place as over against the Arians, who will become increasingly powerful despite Arius's own passing away, both literally when he dies, but also after his going into exile. Arius himself becomes relatively unimportant, whereas his teaching, particularly as defended by Eusebius of Nicomedia, becomes very important and will come to dominate the Christian world until the great shift just before the Council of Constantinople in 381. If we drop down a little further in a highlighted white text, Davis has pointed out that it is only gradually that there will be a clear distinction between the terms ousia, substance or essence, and hypostasis, which will later come to be used in the sense of the Western understanding of person. At present, the terms are, at the time of Nicaea, relatively interchangeable, and therefore you cannot be as specific about both the unity of God, the unity between Father and Son expressed in ousia or essence, and the difference between the persons, which will later be expressed using the word hypostasis. That clear distinction does not exist at this point, and the precise meaning of these terms is, in some senses, up for grabs and will become a matter of very vigorous theological debate. If we drop down now quite a few paragraphs to the next section, the significance of the Council of Nicaea, section 2.4, highlighted with a white and red bordered bar, Davis points out in the first few paragraphs that part of the significance of the council is the shift from faith to dogma, from a general sense of belief that the thing is true to the necessity to articulate it, to reflect on it, to use the gifts of philosophy and intellect to articulate more clearly what it is that is believed. And then very important, the section that is highlighted in 2.4.2 four crucial differences with a blue bar. These, I think, are very helpful summaries, and they will help anticipate what happens in regard to the Arian controversies of the middle part of the fourth century. There are four crucial sectors of religious life in the fourth century that are of importance as distinctions between what the Arian bishops tend to believe and want to defend on the one hand, and what the Orthodox, especially emphasized by and symbolized by the person of Saint Athanasius, will want to defend. The first area is the authority of the emperor. As we'll see, the Arians are much more concerned about linking themselves with defining the authority and right of the emperor. Number two will be the Eucharist, the meaning of the Eucharist, and especially of Eucharistic sharing between those who differ in belief. The office of bishop. Is the bishop's office primarily something that is tied to the function of the emperor, or is it derived from Christ himself and independent of imperial authority? And then the theological understanding of the headship and kingship of Christ. So if we look drop down on this page to number one, the issue of the authority of the emperor, Davis points out that for Eusebius of Caesarea, Christ and Constantine are instruments of the Logos. Constantine becomes a kind of second savior. In later Byzantine tradition, the installation rites of the emperor will include processions with 12 chosen courtiers, so that in a certain sense, the emperor will come to stand for Christ surrounded by the apostles in later court ceremonial. And that's an external depiction of something that the Arians particularly want to emphasize. The emperor does on earth what the Logos does in the cosmos. So there will be a very strong emphasis on imperial authority among the Arians in particular. For the Orthodox, however, there will be a sense that since there is this clear distinction, that there is a clear distinction between earthly authority and the authority of Christ. In section two, the Eucharist will become a very important issue for the Nicenes, who will refuse to celebrate communion with, share communion with whom they disagree. The Arians view the Eucharist as a kind of a continuation or Christianization or substitute for pagan sacrifices, and will want to have communion even with those with whom they disagree, whereas the Nicenes will emphasize that intercommunion is itself an expression of an acknowledgement of one another's doctrinal beliefs. The Arians are convinced that the union of believers within the empire was more important than union or doctrinal unity in the body of Christ. Number three, the Nicene bishops particularly are concerned to trace their lineage to the earthly Christ through the apostles. The doctrine of apostolic succession, of dependence for their authority only on Christ himself, is especially important for the Nicene bishops. The Arians see the emperor as the instrument of the eternal God and will accept imperial appointment and approval as a validation of their authority, and they'll willingly accept transfer by imperial authority from see to see. This is something that the Nicene bishops are much less willing to do and are much more concerned to highlight or emphasize the possibility of complete independence of a church council from the emperor. For the Nicenes, and number four, the bishops can exhort and even rebuke Christian rulers on the basis of apostolic tradition and biblical law. They receive their authority from Christ, and therefore it is for the bishop to rebuke the emperor if need be. One has examples of this, of course, particularly in the person of Saint Ambrose. But the Arians tended to emphasize that while Christ is the head of man, God is the head of Christ, and God, the God enthroned ruler, is superior to the bishops instituted by Christ. So the Arians will not only be dependent on, but will be to a very great extent subject in their authority to the emperor. And so that background will help explain to some extent the developing sympathy for Arianism among the sons of Constantine, and even by Constantine himself after the Council of Nicaea, and the almost frenzied desire to tolerate Arianism within the empire on the part of the emperors. The section that is immediately below this, aftermath, section 2.5, I'd invite you to take a look at yourself. It describes the situation of and the exile of Marcellus of Ancyra, the friend of Athanasius, the rather unfortunate strong emphasizer of the unity of God so much that he is accused, perhaps rightly, of modalist or Sabellian views. And then gradually the shift after Nicaea towards a softening toward the Arian approach, particularly emphasized in the person of Saint Athanasius, whom we will look at separately. Athanasius, the great defender of Nicaea, who was himself present at the council, although didn't become bishop until after the council, then becomes the sign and symbol of the Nicene party and is himself subject to multiple exiles by multiple emperors, including Constantine himself, apparently more for accusations of political and economic malfeasance rather than specifically theological reasons. But as the statement, as you find at the end of this section, finally Arius himself is to be rehabilitated, brought back from exile and restored to communion, but before this can be done publicly in Constantinople, he dies before the ceremony. Of course, the Nicenes see this as the vindication of their point of view that God has struck down Arius, but Arius himself is now no longer important as an individual. His doctrinal viewpoint has been espoused by people like Eusebius of Nicomedia and will be of great importance because of those who believe in his approach rather than because of his own personal teaching.